Hey, this is Mike Klass, and welcome to Vancouver Overcast, a podcast where we have conversations with city leaders and innovators. My guest on this episode is Margareta Dovgal, Director of Research at Resource Work Society, a small BC-based nonprofit providing information on responsible resource development. Margareta recently completed a master's degree in energy and climate policy at University College London. Prior to that, she studied Asian political philosophy at the University of British Columbia. She lives in Vancouver and grew up there as the daughter of Hungarian immigrants in a household that knew the scourge of poverty. Margareta says her work is driven by a passion for poverty reduction. It's partly why she spent the past 2 weeks in the Bulkley Valley, ground zero for a dispute between a group of hereditary chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and proponents of the Coastal GasLink LNG pipeline. The dispute has resulted in a series of echo protests that are impacting communities across Canada. Margareta comes on the podcast today from Smithers, BC. And now, it's time for Vancouver Overcast. Welcome to Vancouver Overcast. This is Mike Klassen, and my guest today is Margareta Dovgal, the Director of Research at Resource Work Society. Those who have been subscribing to our podcast here will know that in episode two, I spoke to the Executive Director, Stuart Muir, and we weren't talking about directly to some of the action that has been happening in the Wet'suwet'en territory with regards to the Coastal GasLink pipeline. At the time, we talked on sort of more broad issues. He was actually at the time in London, England. And so we had that that conversation then. So fast forward these many weeks later, and I get to speak with Margareta, who works with Stuart. Welcome to Vancouver Overcast, Margareta. Can you tell me where you are right now?
Thanks so much, Mike, for having me here today. Currently, I'm in Smithers, which is in northwest BC, and I've been visiting communities along the corridor between Hazelton, New Hazelton, all the way down to Houston. In a sense, this has been the conflict zone, the center of what's been happening across Canada, and we came here to learn a little bit more about what people actually had to say on the ground.
And so how many days or weeks have you been there?
It's about 2 weeks now. I arrived in Prince George about 2 weeks ago, and we drove over. And the time I've gone from Prince George to Kitimat and back to sort of the middle area here. So it's been an exciting and pretty exhausting time just trying to talk to as many people as possible.
When was it that Resource Works decided that they felt that they needed to go right into the community and have you there talking to people?
Well, we're a pretty small team, and my boss texted me one Saturday morning about 2 days before we left, and he said, we need to go up there. We need to go. We need to see what's happening. And this is something that we've done in the past. About 2 years ago, summer of 2018, Stuart Muir and I decided to go and do a documentary tour. We named it Homeland Journey, and we spoke to communities across northern British Columbia, largely Indigenous leaders, chiefs, elected councillors, about their experiences with economic development. And almost accidentally, or very deliberately, because Coastal GasLink was already ramping up at the time, a lot of our interviews ended up being about that. So we decided, you know what, we've been there, we've formed relationships with people on the ground, why don't we go back and actually find out what's happening now?
Some people like having reporters and cameras and perhaps the country or the world's attention being brought to them for reasons that I possibly couldn't explain. How is the community, do you think, reacting to all of this intense glare that's sort of coming to it right now?
I think there's been some challenges there. People are often, I think most people are media shy and don't always have, you know, the right messages lined up. That's something that comes with experience and with pre-planning. So for those who had this, you know, dumped on their doorstep, they've had to contend with just, you know, shock and surprise. But for others, it's been many, many years in the making. They've understood that something is happening, something is coming. There's been pretty active organizing by outsiders coming in and trying to push certain narratives about environmental protection. So folks knew to expect this. But I think the cultural needs for respect, the values that really prioritize privacy and resolving disputes internally have made media, maybe it's made it difficult for media to get through to people. And that's understandable. People are shy. They don't want their culture and everything to be picked and prodded and torn apart. So while we come here, we've been trying to be respectful and ensure that we're working with people collaboratively. When I ask questions, I always, you know, make sure to preface if it's something that I know is controversial, that they have a choice. If they don't want to respond, they don't have to. And I want to be respectful. If I make a mistake, I want them to let me know to the extent that they feel comfortable so that I can do better. And I think the time that I've spent here, you know, intensively talking to people every single day over the last couple of weeks, I've learned a lot about how this culture has thrived and survived decades and centuries of difficulties and outsiders coming in and telling them what to do. And now people are starting to speak up. They don't like how their culture is being used, the name of their nation is being used to move forward a particular agenda.
You use the word outsiders, and outsiders can mean a lot of things. And as you point out, outsiders have been coming into this part of the province of the country for, you know, 150 or more years. What is different about the nature of the people who are coming in now? And I presume that they would be people from industry and also people with other interests.
Absolutely. You know, economic concerns and economic development, there's always a political dimension there. That's inescapable. But there's been a noticeable shift in the last 15 to 20 years, and I've heard this from a whole bunch of different people here, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, towards political advocacy that is largely environmental. So even going back to the War of the Woods, I think this region, the Bulkley Valley, was probably identified as a strategically significant area, one where just a little bit of push in the right directions would enable them to get really, really good results. So I don't think that the economic development and the resource industry that has been here in the past had nearly quite the national level interest in this space. You know, the industry First Nations relationship is evolving. I've heard so many people say that Coastal GasLink has completely changed how consultation is done, how elders and traditional knowledge holders are consulted, and how their opinions are valued in the planning of a project. But that's not something that has always been the case. And a lot of the industrial development in this area hasn't always been done with the support of First Nations. That's not to say that there haven't been economic benefits, but we're seeing, I think, a very, very good shift towards not just Indigenous participation in the local resource economy, but Indigenous leadership. And we recently spoke with Troy Young, who's the director at Kaya Resources, which is partially owned by the Whitsett First Nation, formerly the Morristown Band, and owned by a resource company, a small local family business. And Troy spoke so eloquently about the opportunities that are being created for people here locally, people who in many cases have really, really struggled to gain and maintain employment. So getting to work on a project like this, one that has been developed with the consultation of many, many communities along the route, it will enable people to get out of that cycle of poverty. And I think that's the change that we're seeing for the first time in this area.
I think the cynic out there, and I think it's important to always sort of question these things, but somebody might see, you know, an oil and gas company comes in and they've been able to change their approach to consultation. You talked about how the people working with Coastal GasLink have been able to do things differently. Can you describe a little bit what that is? And is that something that other organizations that want to work with rural communities might want to look at?
I think a lot about ethical market economies and ethical business. You know, there's a lot of theory on this. You go into a business textbook, you go into even a political economy textbook, and there's going to be so many words that have been written about how it should be done, all the different ways of measuring it. The thing that really enables companies to be socially responsible is public pressure. And there's a balance that's required there. You know, the public, you know, was awakened to the use of child labor in Bangladesh to make running shoes. And, you know, that prompted major labor changes to, I think, how Nike procured its products. Examples like that, I think, you know, something happens, there's almost a crisis moment at times, the public is outraged, media gets called in, people do investigative reporting, and companies change a little bit. But, you know, sometimes those things don't always work out for the best. You know, we saw with Nike in Bangladesh that many of the children who were let go from their jobs actually ended up on the streets and in survival sex work. So, you know, the public pressure has two dimensions to it. It enables and forces companies to be more socially responsible, but it can also create unwanted, undesirable outcomes that don't actually substantially improve the conditions. I think the existing institutions that we have in Canada, combined with public pressure, have enabled companies to do better in a way that isn't just done only with public pressure. So the fact that we have extremely stringent rules on environmental regulation. To get a project built, you need to go through super, super, super complicated procedures. You need experts in every possible field under the sun. You need to do socioeconomic research and really understand the impacts of your operations on the community where you're operating, where you're building, you're constructing, who's getting access to jobs, how can these benefits be shared, what are the impacts on local social services, on policing, all of these sorts of things. So I think the fact that Canada has both the public dimension, Canadians are very socially conscious and they want to hold large public and private sector actors accountable for their behavior, and the fact that we have laws that are very, very strict and really bring our industry to a world-class standard ensures that we get outcomes that are consistent with personally what I would like to see industry do, and I think I'm seeing it right now. I have a pretty high bar for that sort of thing, and yeah, I've been happy with what's been done here.
As a student of political history in British Columbia, I remember the summer of 2012, the first ever Amazon ebook came out that I became interested in. It was actually a bestseller at the time. It was a lengthy tome from the former chief of staff to Gordon Campbell, a gentleman by the name of Martin Brown. And he wrote a book that was highly critical, and he continued to be very critical of Christy Clark's administration for a variety of reasons, which surprised a lot of people who thought that he might be more faithful to some of the people who he used to work with in government. But he used the term, it was a phrase that hadn't been a part of my vocabulary, was social license. We don't seem to be talking a lot about social license anymore, or at least it hasn't been frequently brought up and in the conversations that I've been listening to. And I wonder why. I wonder why we're not, because it sounds to me that we are together all trying to achieve some kind of social license through these dialogues.
That's a fantastic question. I think social license is fantastic in principle, and it's something that ideally we could all secure for everything, whether we're in government, whether we're trying to get a major project built in the private sector. But I've learned in the last few years that I've been involved in this space that the idea of social license is very easily weaponized. So, you know, if I go to my political friends, ones who work in constituency offices, work on the Hill, they work in Victoria, Ottawa, you know, they see, and I've seen it myself when I've been on the Hill, hundreds and hundreds of form letters and campaigns being sent to members of parliament and to cabinet ministers. A lot of the things that we hear about, oh, a concerned citizen is really worried about the impact of a local mill on butterflies locally. Things like that don't often happen organically. Sometimes it is a concerned citizen who has legitimate complaints, but most of the time there's some organization to it. And you see this done really, really effectively on every possible policy issue under the sun. I have friends who are advocates for donor-conceived people, and they are very interested in the health policy space, and they do their best to be organized and connect with policymakers. They have really, really substantive criticisms of the assisted human reproduction stuff that goes on in Canada, but because they don't have the resources to hire a lobbyist to do really, really extensive policy research that's targeted to convince decision makers, their calls don't get returned, and they struggle to make the news in the way that if real valid concerns always made their way to the top, they should be heard, but they're not being heard. I think examples like that are universal. Sometimes the most mundane uninteresting and least sexy topics become the topic, the subject of social license and, you know, public approval debates. And I've really learned that that frequently just comes down to how well-funded and how organized a lobbyist and an influencer is. Returning to the topic of environmental approvals and all these things, I've become cynical. I see the need and the value of companies and project proponents speaking to communities first and ensuring that communities aren't just being told what's happening. They're buying into it. They're co-developing. Their input and their needs and concerns are actually being met. That's super, super important. And, you know, my cynicism about the weaponization of social license doesn't mean that I don't think that's important. But I've seen how in the environmental space, the fact that Canada has this amazing concern, amazing responsiveness to the public's needs, I've seen how that characteristic of our governance is easily used by outsiders who want global and national environmental solutions. So the conventional approaches of electing incredibly decarbonization-oriented politicians hasn't really been working. You know, the general public is talking more and more about reducing the use of carbon, carbon intensity. I mean, these are phrases that most people will have heard at some point in their lives. And I feel like that's really new. We're seeing just a higher interest in climate policy in general. But I don't think that necessarily what we're seeing in Canada and the organization that's targeted at Canadian industry reflects what's actually needed from an evidence-based approach. I studied climate policy, I did my master's in it, and you know, there's undeniably so much we need to do to improve. We need to change our economies, we need to decarbonize, but people can disagree reasonably, educated people can disagree about how that needs to happen and where that change needs to occur. And the fact that Canada has a political system that is responsive to the needs of citizens means that that makes us an incredibly, incredibly great target for anyone who wants to see any energy exporting country stop exporting oil and gas products. So instead of, you know, going to Algeria and influencing Algerian domestic politics or going to Saudi Arabia, I mean, good luck with that. Activists who are thinking globally about ways to reduce emissions are instead going to Canada, which is responsible for about, what, 2% of global GHG emissions? You know, we're a large developed country that has amazing pathways for people to have their voice heard. And when people are looking strategically for prospective targets, of course they're going to pick Canada. That's obvious, right?
I think what has perhaps frustrated people that look from the outside into some of the narrative put forward by the environmental activist movement is how strident their approach has been. I think that's probably why a lot of the general public are slower to support them as well. And it seems to me that they take a position that has almost the appearance of no internal debate. Like a lot of us on the other side looking in might kind of go, okay, how do we get there? Do we adopt more nuclear, more hydro? Does that mean more dams? Do we use LNG as a way to get coal out of the system and reduce? And, you know, there's a pathway that can be seen by a lot of people who take a more nuanced view on how we achieve those goals. And then there's those who say we must stop at all costs. Is that something that you've seen through both your studies and also the work that you're doing with ResourceWorks?
You're right, there's a tremendous disconnect between what needs to happen and where the pressure is being applied. I've seen people who yell until they're blue in the face about the need to decarbonize, and they think the only way to do that, the only meaningful way to do that, is to oppose Canadian energy development. And they don't for a second consider the fact that every single aspect of their consumer lifestyle depends on oil and gas globally. I mean, we're a part of an incredibly complicated and carbon intensive supply chain. You know, I get some cleaning products at the store, produced with petrochemicals, packaged in petrochemicals, brought to me using petroleum products, consumed in maybe my washing machine, using energy that often is supplemented using oil and gas products. I mean, every single piece of my life connects to that global supply chain. It's not a domestic issue. I saw a headline this morning that made me chortle. You can get a crib that is entirely fossil fuel free, produced with wood that was harvested with an electric powered chainsaw, which doesn't work as well as a gas powered one, it turns out, trucked to a mill in an electric vehicle. Kind of hard to do if your forest roads don't have electric vehicle fuel up stops, and they often don't. Brought to a mill that's powered on renewable electricity and shipped using trains that are electric powered. The price tag for such a crib for your fossil fuel free baby is $28,000. I mean, right? Okay. Like the things that we depend on in a daily sense.
Well, you like just have to make every Margarita, don't you just have to make a lot more of them, and then maybe they drive the price down to maybe, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, you know, at some point. Anyway, you're right. It is an extreme example, but of course, I suppose that's where the world is going too, right? We are looking to try and mitigate, find alternative fuel sources. Yes, electrify as much of the grid as possible, and you're right. There's no question there will be a reliance upon petrochemical and oil and gas for the foreseeable future. It's just a question about how much of it is, I suppose, in the overall consumption of the average Canadian.
Mm, yeah, no, you're right. I mean, not to get too lost in the weeds on that example. I think my point is more that the concern that we have about Canada being an energy exporter, I think that's more reflective of the messaging we've been hearing, the really, really tactical and strategically brilliant messaging we've been hearing about where the weak point is for an energy developer, for an energy producing country. Our lives are powered by Saudi oil. Everything that we do globally, you know, the travel that you and I do when we fly somewhere, like that's dependent on these sorts of things. And as a responsible consumer, all responsible consumers should be asking themselves not how can I stop Canada from creating jobs for oil and gas workers and, you know, furthering Canada's prosperity, but how can I instead look at my overall lifestyle and reduce my use of products that are incredibly carbon intensive on a policy level. And I think that's going beyond the consumer level, which I think is really important. On a policy level, we also need to think a lot about energy use generally. So something like the carbon price is a fantastic mechanism to accomplish what we need. It's a market-driven tool. It sets incentives, or it disincentivizes the consumption of products that are super, super carbon intensive. And that's good. That's how you accomplish it. You know, you can do that also with direct funding for innovation in industry. I've been doing a lot of research on that topic, and I think it's important that policymakers are looking at ways to ensure that our industries and our businesses and the things that drive the Canadian economy have all of the incentives in place to find less polluting, more environmentally conscious solutions for their business needs, whether that's transportation, where you get your electricity from, all of these sorts of things. I mean, everyone, when they hear the word energy, people often think of power grids and hydro and dams. Energy is transportation. Energy is how you get to work. Energy is how the household goods you have, the clothes you wear on your back, get to where you are. It's the fact that the maritime shipping industry, which keeps the global economy running, often uses really, really low quality fuel. And that's changing. There are new standards coming in. But I don't think at the end of the day that aiming your efforts as an eco-friendly activist at shutting down the exports of oil and gas products from the most ethical, socially responsible producer in the world is the right use of your energy, when it's our lifestyles and it's the decisions that we make collectively that actually are the problem.
So I brought you on to the Vancouver Overcast podcast partly because of where you are right now. And the both of us have read your bio. Both of us are essentially Vancouver raised, you know, urban, you know, kids now, grown ups that probably have more of that perspective of the Southwest from a city. You're up in the north now, and I fully acknowledge that neither one of us represent indigenous voices. But can you sort of portray a little bit of what you've seen and what you perceive life is like in that community? And I also want to just repeat something that somebody said to me recently, because a lot of politicians speak about how they are consulting with rural communities as well as First Nations communities. But as somebody pointed out to me, it's very hard to separate out the two. A lot of our communities are very integrated in terms of the First Nations populations and other non-Indigenous peoples in those areas. So can you tell us a little bit of what you see and what you perceive from being from the city?
No, as a city girl, I grew up looking at the beautiful landscape of Vancouver, the North Shore Mountains, and sort of mentally blurring out the fact that there was a massive port sitting there. It wasn't until maybe the end of my first year in university when I asked myself, wait a minute, where does all this urban prosperity come from? And I mean, it sounds like a talking point, but I really had like a light bulb moment when I realized that the fact that even though I grew up below the poverty line, my parents really struggled. My father was a heavy drinker. You know, the conditions that would have made my life really, really difficult if it wasn't for the fact that I was in a very, very wealthy part of the world, in a very wealthy city. These sorts of things started me thinking about where that prosperity is coming from. And, you know, traveling across northern BC, which I've done over the last few years, and I'm here again doing it now, has really just opened my eyes to what difference the opportunity makes when there's a thriving economic base in a community. You go to the town of Smithers, and I'm in Smithers right now, and there's lots of mining companies all around, and you know, you can see there's money pouring into the town that keeps the locals thriving. There's like little gourmet coffee shops and things that you would expect to see in a larger city. But you drive for an hour and a half north, you go into a little village like Kispiox, and you realize that a lot of the residents, they don't have driver's licenses, neither did their parents. They don't have opportunities to get to work. I've heard a friend of mine tell me, who works extensively in these communities, that many people need glasses and they don't even have prescription glasses. So they can't even, they don't drive, they can't see. Like super, super basic things that you and I benefit from regardless of our socioeconomic background are unattainable for residents of remote and northern rural communities. And like you said, these are predominantly First Nations communities. The reserve system, you know, I'm not a scholar, I'm not an expert on this, but everything that I've studied sort of indicates to me that there was this deliberate attempt over Canada's colonial laws to ensure that these communities almost were like prisons. People couldn't leave at various points. They couldn't hire lawyers to get access to their lands. And the fact that the economic activity that has been occurring around their areas hasn't directly benefited them ensured that poverty would continue. People were forcibly removed from their traditional ways of life that could be very prosperous and enable people to have rich, happy, healthy, fulfilling lives, and have instead put them into systemic cycles of poverty. And poverty that isn't really, it's not solved with a welfare check. I know that's a line that you'll hear a lot of politicians say. I grew up receiving social assistance payments. That's how my parents made ends meet. But the fact that I could go to like a world-class public school, and I went to university and I got a master's degree, these are things that I was only able to do because I came from a wealthy region that had benefited from the resources in our country and the export of those resources. And I see people here locally who didn't get to benefit from any of that. And, you know, no amount of social assistance is going to get people into the workforce if there aren't jobs. It's plain as night and day to me. I heard someone tell me that even though there's this criticism that pipeline jobs, construction jobs, and CGL are just temporary, the fact remains that someone will get trained up. They'll maybe get their driver's license, they'll get their tickets, their first aid, their bear safety to, you know, brave the wilds with the grizzlies all around here, or I think it's grizzlies. And after that, they'll have the skills and the resources to go and do another job. They will ensure that they're taken care of, any family they have is provided for. So projects like this, they aren't just, oh, it's a temporary thing and then, you know, we sacrifice the environment for it, which, by the way, doesn't happen. But they will enable people who are struggling with systemic intergenerational poverty to get out of those situations. And I think all urbanites need to open their eyes to that.
My guest is Margareta Dovgal. She's the Director of Research for Resource Work Society. She's speaking with me from Smithers, BC. We'll be back in a moment. So you did a what you described as a Twitter rant just this week, and it blew up and it caught the attention of a lot of people, including columnist Terry Glavin, who writes for National Post. And I wonder if you might sort of summarize what you were trying to say in that, which Glavin seemed to agree with.
So, you know, being here for a couple of weeks, you know, that doesn't replace growing up in these communities. And I don't mean to say that I've had some unbeatable insights and I understand the whole picture of what happens in the Wet'suwet'en community, but I have done my very best to align everything I learned about colonization, you know, colonial theory. I have a humanities degree, so I've read plenty of it and I know the ins and outs of how reconciliation on paper could be accomplished. But what I've seen here is the voices of only some people, people who have probably reasonable and, you know, long-standing concerns about sovereignty are being utilized in order to push an environmental agenda. And I've seen the devastation that it creates here in these communities. You know, cousins don't talk to each other. People who grew up together, sisters and brothers, won't even speak because they have differences of opinion about climate action and the environmental impacts of certain projects. But those differences of opinion become so hostile, so conflict-laden because communities are almost being forced to make it polarized, to have these arguments with people. I hear so much misinformation and it makes me so angry. Someone was telling me that they had been told by authorities in their communities, as an Indigenous person here, there's going to be oil, there's going to be bitumen in that pipeline and it's going to cross under rivers. And when it bursts, the oil is going to kill all the salmon that I harvest. And that just, that made me really, 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 really frustrated. I hate the fact that misinformation is being fed to people and it's exploiting their values. It's exploiting their need and desire to protect their local environments, which they cherish so closely. I've also heard a lot about just local governance challenges. You know, there's a group of men, a buddy of mine called them the Fabulous Five, and my buddy's Wet'suwet'en, just so we're clear, who have been in Eastern Canada this week trying to get a meeting. It seems like they were trying to get a meeting with the Prime Minister, or they refused to get a meeting. It's been a bit unclear here, but they claim to speak on behalf of the whole community, and so many of their supporters are painting these chiefs, these hereditary chiefs, as the ultimate authorities, the undisputed voices of the Wet'suwet'en people. And that is so at odds with what I've seen here. You know, lots of people have reasonable concerns, and many people here are hereditary chiefs. This is a really rich, dynamic culture that has its own participatory and representative democracy in place. That is so, so fascinating and valuable, but it's not you know, winner takes all. It's not just because I'm a chief, I get to speak over everyone. And these are things that my sources, the friends that I have here have told me is happening. The traditional governance system, which prioritizes decisions by consensus, decisions that are informed by all of the chiefs, not just some of the chiefs, and all members of the community, these decision-making mechanisms aren't being utilized the way that they should. There's been, you know, tremendous changes that have occurred because people are migrating out, because there are super challenging socioeconomic problems here where you know, high suicide rate, lots of health problems that aren't resolved. So the mortality rate is pretty high. Like, so many people have told me stories about losing family members to death, to suicide, to violence, to addiction. Like, these are common stories. And the fact that the hereditary system is surviving and reviving, I think, is a testament to its enduring strength. But like most things, it's not a romanticized, perfect whole where every single buys into it. At the end of the day, it's a political system. It's not my political system. I can't speak for people here, but it's a system that any political system has disagreements. People have different perspectives. And I don't think it's a colonial mentality to say that voices deserve to be heard and that suppressing dissent is not a good thing for democracy, whichever shape that democracy takes. People tell me about being bullied, harassed, you know, their family members being turned against them, about some women being, who are hereditary chiefs, actually being excluded from the feast hall where community decisions are made, where, you know, the most significant events in people's lives are celebrated and noted. You know, funeral feasts are a really big thing here. People honor the lives of those they loved and lost at these feasts. And when somebody is excluded from the feast hall because they support oil and gas development done responsibly, that's not good for anyone. And when those things are brought to the national forum, when these issues here locally are elevated and suddenly everyone is talking about solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en people, what does that mean? Do you understand the people that are here and their diversity of perspectives? Or are you only interested in something that accords with your primitivist view of what Indigenous people want? And, like, frankly, that's what I'm seeing from a lot of urban progressives who've never even been north of Whistler. They think that just because many Indigenous peoples have, you know, unique respect for and connections with the land and the management of the land and resources, that must necessarily mean they are opposed to all projects and all local development. That's not true. That's so paternalistic. And, you know, it frustrates me as a self-described progressive. I don't like that. And I think it frustrates a lot of the Wet'suwet'en people I've spoken to. And now they're speaking up. They're telling these protesters to go, you know, run off the other way, stop bothering us. And we've literally heard that in the last few days.
Some of that division of communities has been spoken about well by Ellis Ross, who's the Skeena MLA, former Haisla chief, who talks about when groups come in and really leave in their wake a lot of people not talking to each other, which is very sad. Can I just ask you a little bit about the protests themselves? I gather, and I don't really want to speak too much about this because I think it's unfortunate that these measures are being taken, but I understand that there are some on the access roads through the disputed territory that there have been some sort of traps set up. Do you know anything about that, or are people talking about that?
Yeah, I've heard that from so many people. And I think the one that is most horrifying to me is that there are so many hardworking men and women, but mostly men, working in forestry. They're lumberjacks, you know, they drive, cut forestry products back into town, that are both non-Indigenous or they are Wet'suwet'en, and they're actually afraid. There was an example of one of the bridges on the way in that direction actually being sabotaged. And, you know, contrary to the popular perception, this isn't some pristine, undeveloped wilderness. Like, it's gorgeous out there. It's so, so beautiful. But this is an industrial forest area that's being blockaded and occupied. It's accessible by a forestry road. There's been decades of development. In fact, one of the guys who sort of been supportive of and leading the protests locally, he actually owns a lot of and has developed large swathes of forestry in this area, just around the access road. So it's interesting to me that there's this flagrant disregard for the safety of workers being shown by outside protesters who think that they speak for the Wet'suwet'en people. I don't think if they had integrity that they would do something that low, that they would put people into danger. You know, other examples of trees being cut just a little bit so that when people come too close, the tree will fall and possibly kill or maim them. That's awful. And then, of course, law enforcement as well. I mean, the anti-cop narratives are dehumanizing. Like, saying, oh, they're pigs, they're awful. Like, that's so, so, so violent. Violent in the way that it's come out. Is people think that because someone's enforcing the laws of a country, they deserve to have their lives put into danger. And that the fact that they're trying to garner sympathy in doing these things, it just boggles the mind. I don't understand how this isn't universally being decried as violent and wholly unacceptable.
So I've got a young family member, Generation Z, I guess, that has really challenged me from the perspective of social justice on what's happening up there. And where they're getting their information, I'm not entirely clear. I think a lot of it is anecdotal, but they talk about how the RCMP are actively blocking people from their homes is one claim, which I can't respond to. There is questions about the RCMP's role itself as a sort of a colonizing force. But in the context of this particular dispute, are those things all as relevant as some of the things you've been looking at? Or do we have to think holistically about all of these historical aspects and, as you put it, the people who are enforcing Canada's laws in that region?
Yeah, thinking holistically is a good idea in this space. You know, we can't divorce our discussions here from the fact that there is an enduring colonial legacy that has quite literally destroyed communities and cultures. And I don't think for a second that that needs to be brushed over. I know some people, maybe more on the right, are uncomfortable with this because they see the risk, perhaps, of these sorts of narratives delegitimizing Canada and delegitimizing the institutions that we have. I don't think that's a real risk. I think that the very real pain and suffering and the enduring legacies of discrimination that continue are being used to cloak protesters and their actions from scrutiny and from careful consideration. Canadians need to think carefully about what they think reconciliation looks like. And, you know, that's not something I have all the answers to. I don't think anyone does. But, you know, personally, I think self-government is important. Accountable self-government, where members of First Nations have their voices heard. That doesn't mean that that model has to look like elected band councils. But whatever it looks like, and however it corresponds with traditional governance, that needs to be respected. And, you know, coming in here, I was open-minded. I wasn't, you know, bought into a narrative that all land defenders, as they call themselves, are necessarily acting maliciously. But it's pretty clear to me from the time that I've been on the ground and the little dozens of conversations I've had with Wet'suwet'en people, that there isn't this unassailable force of unity among Wet'suwet'en people that, you know, sticks their middle finger up to the Crown, to RCMP, and the colonial legacy. Like, so many of the people I've spoken to have worked in the legal space. Like, a lady that I know who happens to be a hereditary chief worked as a parole officer
trying to prevent recidivism and sexualized violence against women. She worked with sex offenders, and she implemented restorative justice principles in her work. She's also been an oil and gas worker. She's also done so many things. She can collect a testimony for the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. You know, people live complex lives. It's not, oh, we're authentic and legitimate and we're against colonialism, therefore, you know, we think Canada as a state needs to evaporate. Like, that's a narrative that I think is really attractive to a forward-thinking, progressive, young audience. And it's a narrative that was probably more attractive to me when I was doing my undergrad at UBC. But it, at times, is divorced from reality because it fails to acknowledge the complexity of ways in which people constitute their identities as Indigenous peoples. And that's a theme that keeps hitting me as I do these interviews. The fact that someone is a resource worker, or, you know, they benefit from a family member working in the resource space, whether that's for Coastal GasLink, for the forestry companies that operate in this area, or mining kind of in the region, that doesn't mean that they are no longer living their lives traditionally, that they no longer have respect for their traditional governance. And what you were saying earlier about, oh, you know, these people's homes are being blockaded, like, I heard so many stories about the protest cabins built in the woods to prevent resource extraction. A lady who calls herself a spokesperson for a certain clan set up a cabin in the woods, first to protest the expansion of Huckleberry Mine. Then I think someone told me there were some issues with the local forestry that was going on, and eventually that cabin turned into something else. Her use of that land turned into a resistance to the evil imperialists and their Coastal GasLink project. Like, the framing of it is very deliberate. They're appealing to young people who want Canada to do better, who see problems with the current system, and they're framing it in a way that makes it seem like the solution necessarily has to come from these people. But that's not consistent with the amazing work being done to revitalize culture and, you know, bring local economic development to these communities by people who know that Canada has done bad stuff, wanted to do better, but don't think that, you know, overthrowing the state and blocking the economy is the way to do it.
You're listening to Vancouver Overcast. I'm Mike Klassen. My guest is Margareta Dovgal. She is the Director of Research at Resource Work Society. I really learned about Margareta from seeing some of her words on Twitter. Margareta, I want to ask you about the accusations that you're simply a shill for the oil and gas industry, and the way that some people have come after you on Twitter and your attempts to defend yourself. I'd be interested in getting your perspective, because social media is obviously incredibly powerful, and this particular tool, Twitter, is one that seems to have a lot of these very active conversation, and it's not necessarily a very positive environment sometimes as well.
You know, the harassment of dissenting voices is par for the course with this crowd and the rent-a-mob that comes out whenever somebody applies even the most minute amount of scrutiny to what these protesters and pressure groups are doing in the Bulkley Valley. It really frustrates me to see women who are courageously speaking up, including, you know, Wet'suwet'en elder Rita George, against this bullying, to have their credibility questioned. Like, some guy was saying on Twitter, oh, her family works for oil and gas, so she's bought and paid for. And, you know, hearing that criticism a lot, like, I follow Twitter pretty closely, especially recently. Like, I haven't really engaged as much until the last couple of weeks. And, you know, I rarely see men who have nuanced and interesting opinions that are generally supportive of responsible resource development be attacked and pilloried in quite the same way, even when those men literally work in oil and gas. I don't actually work in oil and gas. I'm a consultant. I do gender-based analysis. I write on resource issues. I've been writing for Resource Works for about 5 years now. I started as a volunteer, and, you know, it's the things that I write, they always accord with my values and my principles. I want to see Canada's economy benefit all of us. I want us to do better as a country at reconciliation, at poverty reduction, at environmental policy. And these are all things that are implicated when I write for Resource Works. They're core to my heart and my values. And, you know, I'm not a paid lobbyist. I'm not talking to decision makers, trying to convince them to do something for a private client. I think Canada's economy is for everyone. And if we want to see positive change, we want to see jobs benefit everyone, even those who haven't previously been included in the labor market. We need to take ownership of that. And you don't do that by saying, burn it all down, burn down the system. You do it by advocating for what's important to you. And that's what I'm trying to do. And that's what so many others are trying to do. And, you know, when it comes to the Wet'suwet'en community, I want the women here, and the men too, but the women who've been bullied, to have the courage to speak up and not be accused of being bought and paid for just because their vision of a bright and positive future for their children and grandchildren is one that includes maybe oil and gas, maybe mining, maybe forestry. These things don't mean that people don't have principles. Everyone is operating with their moral compass. But the suppression of debate and the insults, they tell us that there's just not really substance left. If that's what your criticisms are, that you don't like that somebody has written things in the past that don't accord with your values, they're not making any reasonable points. You're just resorting to desperate tactics because you know that your points won't actually win.
I think you've answered my last question, which is what you really would like to see as a result of what's happening right now and how the conversation could be changed. But maybe I'll just ask you this sort of final question, because we've spoken for almost an hour now, and I feel like we could go on even longer, but are you hopeful that things will land in a positive place from the current conflict?
Well, it's not just this. I've said this before to people. What we're seeing is a calculated, theatrically orchestrated show of force. Activist networks that have spent decades embedding themselves in local communities are finally showing the world what they're capable of. And I don't think that the majority of Canadians are with them. The polling indicates that they're not. And I think the more Canadians learn about their actual motives and their intentions, the more their credibility will suffer. So I don't have necessarily a negative view of this current crisis that we're facing. I think that the sane and sober voices, the reasoned voices of Wet'suwet'en community leaders, working people, people who are providing a better life for themselves and their families, those are going to come out on top. And I'm hopeful for that. And I'm hopeful that this community can come together and heal after all of the division that's been created here. In terms of the national issues around environmental activism, you know, it's important for decision makers to be held to account, but you don't do that by blockading the movement of people and goods, by subverting the conventional agreed upon by consensus ways of getting your voice heard. You know, we have amazing institutions that will always need to do better, but we have amazing institutions that enable people's voices to be heard. And resorting to violent tactics, screaming in the face of legislators trying to get to their office to hear a throne speech, that's not how you do it. I have an enormous amount of positivity and optimism that Canadians see the value of responsibly developed Canadian natural resources, and that they're going to realize very soon that there's been a bit of a bamboozling that has happened, where our sympathies and our inclinations to hear out minority perspectives have been utilized in order to shift the attention away from the agenda of the activists. So yeah, I'm hopeful that media will keep reporting on it. And as I go and continue to share more of the perspectives I'm gathering here, that folks will be listening.
Well, I very much look forward to learning more of what you do discover in your journey up in the Bulkley Valley. Where would our listeners be able to find more of some of the information that you're putting forward? And maybe you can even tell us your Twitter handle, and as well, perhaps online, where people can find out more about the work that you're doing.
So if you want to learn more about ResourceWorks generally, that can be found at resourceworks.com. And my Twitter handle is Margareta with a 7 instead of a T, M-A-R-G-A-R-E-7-A. That's at Margareta. And you can also find work being done by Stuart. We're out here together at SJMuir on Twitter. Looking forward to keeping you in the loop. Thanks so much for having me on, Mike.
I very much appreciate you coming on the podcast today and sharing your insights. My guest has been Margareta Dovgal, the Director of Research for Resource Work Society. This is Vancouver Overcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate us, and tell your friends about the podcast. My name is Mike Klassen. Thanks for listening.